From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away. I'm Bob Garfield. This week, the highly respected British medical journal The Lancet formally retracted a 1998 article that suggested a link between the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine and autism. The reasons for the retraction were many, chief among them serious ethical concerns surrounding the study's lead doctor, Andrew Wakefield. According to the UK's General Medical Council, Wakefield performed overly invasive tests on children, paid the kids to participate, and failed to disclose ties to a lawyer representing parents of children with autism. Furthermore, no other study has reproduced Wakefield's research, and 10 out of his 13 research collaborators have disavowed the article. So how did bad science make its way into a respected medical journal and into the collective psyche? The Lancet's editor, Dr. Richard Horton, says it's a mess he's been trying to clean up for a decade.
What we've tried to do over the past 10 years is, first of all, publish papers that have shown the safety of the vaccine. And secondly, the lesson we've learned is that anything we publish will be picked up and used. It certainly made us much more risk averse, much more conservative. We now try to be even more cautious about the kinds of work we publish, recognizing that you cannot have a closed discussion in the scientific community about anything today. Everything is accessible to everybody at any time.
And those who are paying attention to what you publish do not necessarily approach it with the same level of understanding and report it with the same level of nuance that perhaps you'd prefer. I think what you're saying is, apart from the Lancet's errors here, the media, by doing what the media do, compounded the problem maybe exponentially.
This was a system failure. We failed. I think the media failed. I think government failed. I think the scientific community failed. And we all have to very critically examine what part we played in this. I think the media certainly did sustain the story over a decade. It became a political story with, did Tony Blair have his son vaccinated with MMR or not? Suddenly a huge media furor around that. Andrew Wakefield would make many statements during the course of those 10 years. Each of which was dutifully reported as if it was the gospel truth. Profiles of him were written as this charismatic doctor saving the lives of children. I mean, I think we all have to look very carefully at ourselves and say, we really messed up here.
While it's nice to imagine that this episode will chasten the media and force it to take much more care about how it reports any kind of medical research, the fact is that a bajillion different media organizations with fewer resources than they used to have, not more, are apt to not change a great deal. So when you publish something, what do you have to do in this day and age to make sure that there's no repeat of the MMR debacle?
We used to think that we could publish speculative research which advanced interesting new ideas, which may be wrong, but which were important to provoke debate and discussion. We don't think that now. What we don't seem able to do is we don't seem able to have a rational conversation in the public space about difficult, controversial issues without people drawing a conclusion which could be very, very adverse.
But is this a case where these conversations would have been better confined to the medical community, that somehow the public should not be participating in these things because we simply don't have the wherewithal to evaluate them?
I think that although that's a nice thought, the problem is that that's just impossible today. The 19th century days where you could sit in the salon of the Royal Society and have a private conversation amongst your fellows, it just doesn't exist anymore. So I think, yeah, too much information in this particular case is a bad thing, which seems to go against every kind of democratic principle that we believe in. But in the case of science, it seems to be true.
And finally, 12 years later, as you retract the original research, does it matter? Isn't it just way too late to have any impact on the public?
I certainly hope that our retraction today will help to reassure parents that there really isn't anything to be concerned about with the vaccine. But I do think that there is a history over many hundreds of years of anti-vaccine movements. And, you know, we are going to see many, many more vaccines available to the general public. And we all have to be very vigilant about making sure that we build trust and confidence in these vaccines, which are going to transform the landscape of health over the next generation.
All right. Well, Richard, thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Dr. Richard Horton is the editor of The Lancet.
It really is all of humanity that is under threat.
That was World Health Organization Director General Margaret Chan back in April assessing the H1N1 virus, aka the swine flu. The new strain of flu, said the WHO, could spread quickly, mutate lethally, eventually infect 2 billion people, and claim countless lives worldwide. Here's what it sounded like on TV.
46 states now reporting widespread swine flu.
Air Force are on high alert for that swine flu outbreak, which is quickly spreading this morning from
Mexico. It really doesn't get more serious than that now, does it? If you inhabit Earth, you are in danger of being infected.
Alarms were sounded. The 1918 global flu catastrophe was invoked. Nations were mobilized. Vaccines were mass-produced and administered. Billions of dollars were spent. And now, 9 months later, it's fair to say that humanity has been spared.
What we saw with this virus as it unfolded over months and months, that it didn't raise to the same level of severity as the previous influenza pandemics.
Glenn Nowak is a spokesman for the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
It's easy in hindsight to now say that, you know, maybe those things were overstated.
The latest outbreak of swine flu fever came last week when the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe announced an investigation into whether the World Health Organization's dire warnings were influenced by representatives of the pharmaceutical industry who participated in the WHO's swine flu deliberations. That investigation was prompted by complaints from epidemiologists that the WHO-ordained flu pandemic was never a true pandemic to begin with.
In former times, pandemic is understood as something very extraordinary, dangerous, and with high mortality, high morbidity. Now we just have a normal flu, and it's called a pandemic.
Wolfgang Vordag is a German politician and epidemiologist who accuses the WHO of caving to pharma by redefining the word pandemic to exclude any measure of severity or virulence. Though H1N1 was not especially lethal, he says, it nonetheless fulfilled the new, broader definition and thus forced health officials across the globe to mobilize, alarm the public, and, of course, buy vaccine from the drug industry, all for an outbreak less deadly than most ordinary seasonal flus.
Fact is, there is a mild flu. Fact is, we spent billions of euros and dollars for unnecessary vaccinations.
Or did we? First, the WHO categorically denies expanding the definition of pandemic for any reason other than health preparedness. Secondly, it's impossible to know whether the less-than-estimated spread of the disease was largely because of mass vaccinations and other public health measures. It also bears questioning whether governments, in dealing with an unpredictable and potentially fast-mutating new virus, should be just crossing their fingers and hoping for the best.
Yeah, it would be insane to prepare for anything less than the worst case. People act like this flu was nothing. It was all media hype. 11,000 people died.
Donald McNeil covers public health for the New York Times.
So acting as if nothing happened here and it was all media hype, I think, is wrong. Had it gone the other way, we'd have the government officials hanging from lampposts now for having failed to develop a vaccine.
But what about the media? What was their responsibility for evaluating the conflicting predictions from various government agencies?
What we saw initially in April and May of last year was a lot of hysterical and sensational coverage on cable television news and also on local television news.
Eric Kleinenberg is a professor of sociology at New York University, specializing in the intersection of media and public health.
one of the things we learned is how difficult it is to do risk communication through the media at a time when there are so many conflicting sources of information and authority out there. Most famously, the White House Council of Scientific Advisors issued that report estimating the possibility of 30,000 to 90,000 deaths and tens of millions of cases in the U.S. The next day, the head of the CDC expressed skepticism about that. The head of the Department of Health and Human Services essentially ignored it. And in a context like that, it's very difficult for journalists and for ordinary citizens to figure out what to believe.
Initially, he says, print publications did a very good job of reporting the outbreaks, in Mexico, for instance, and putting the data in perspective. But as various government agencies weighed in with conflicting projections of the disease's toll, Kleinenberg believes the reporting often devolved into a typical he said, she said narrative.
We once lived in a world where there was a government authority that spoke with a fairly clear voice and told us what was happening when there was an emerging health problem and what we should do to stay safe. Journalists' role during a time like that is largely to translate the government's public health message, to ask some skeptical questions, sure. But really, this is a time when journalists play their public interest role. We don't live in that world anymore.
No, we live in a world where the suspicion of government is so high and the pharmaceutical industry is so corrupt that the World Health Organization can't cry wolf without being suspected of shady dealings with the village merchants. We also live in a world where ideologues of all stripes interpret the lack of immediate catastrophe in public health, in climate change, in the economy, as proof that no threat ever existed. In their view, the media are willing dupes or worse. The New York Times' Donald McNeil, however, doesn't see it that way.
I think about all the reporters who spent most of their careers covering the Soviet Union and the possibility of World War III, and they may have spent 40 years doing it, and World War III didn't happen. Does this mean they wasted their lives? Or was the news worth covering anyway?
The great non-plague of 2009 might suggest a scandal, and that's being looked into. Meantime, didn't someone once say, no news is good news? This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Back in October, we spoke with veteran sports reporter Rich Hammond, who, after a decade covering the Los Angeles Kings hockey team for the LA Daily News, had been hired to cover the Kings for the Kings. To bypass the pesky media and to get news directly to the fans, leagues and conferences and teams have been cultivating their own websites, television networks, and even hiring veteran sports broadcasters. Here's NBC's Bob Costas for the Major League Baseball Network.
Does today feel better in some sense because at least you're unburdening yourself?
I don't know. I mean, it just, all I want to do is come clean.
That was Costas last month with former St. Louis Cardinals slugger Mark McGwire after McGwire had admitted to using steroids during his playing days. It was an eye-opener, but what McGwire said was not nearly as important as where he said it. Or anyway, so argues Tim Franklin, director of the National Sports Journalism Center at Indiana University.
I really think that this was a watershed moment in the transformation of sports media in America. It's really the first megastory that was broken on a league-owned network. And I think it symbolizes the paradigm shift from traditional legacy news organizations to new media. And in sports, especially, to league-owned, team-owned, conference-owned networks and websites. The reason is that sports online and on cable and satellite is exploding, and the leagues want a cut of that revenue.
Let me stop you there, because the leagues have already gotten a cut of that revenue. They've sold rights to their games to the networks and to ESPN for the whole history of broadcasts. What they want is a much bigger cut of the revenue, no?
Absolutely. I mean, I've seen projections that online ad revenue, for example, to sports media sites will double in the 5-year period that ends in 2012. It could be a $3 billion revenue stream into sports websites. So we're talking about a very large amount of money. And the leagues and the conferences and the teams, which have all been impacted by the Great Recession of the last couple of years, they see this money flowing into digital and they want a piece of it, a must-have credibility.
We'll get to the conflict of interest issues in just a moment. But first, I want to talk about the emergence of these channels. I guess sort of under the radar, MLB and the NFL developed their own cable channels in the last 10 years or so. And it seems like every football conference out there, I know there's a Big Ten TV, there's even a Big Sky conference, regional sports channel, you know, and I'm talking about these juggernauts like Weber State and Montana State with their own cable channel. Where did these channels all come from?
Well, you're absolutely right. There are now more than 50 regional sports cable channels across the country. The Big Ten Network is now in its third year, already profitable, by the way. And there's buzz that many of the major conferences may have their own networks in the near future. And the reason is they see the business model of subscription fees and advertising revenue as being large enough that they can profit from creating their own networks. So there is a powerful economic incentive. And also, when they're not broadcasting games, it's an opportunity for universities to get the word out about academic programs in addition to sports programs. So the conferences, I think, really have a powerful incentive to create these networks, and I think you're going to see more of them.
So I want to get back to the McGuire interview as being the watershed that you say it is. It gives legitimacy, you say, to the MLB network, not just as a purveyor of baseball games, but as a news site about baseball. Is that the nub of the situation?
Yes, it is. They broke a major national story on their network, and I think you're going to be seeing more of that. I think it's a trend that's about to take off at Major League Baseball, the NFL, the NBA, and the other networks for economic reasons, and also because of the ability to have a little bit more control, perhaps, over the message. So what does it mean? It means that fans will have even more choice, much more availability of news and information about their teams than they've ever had. The question, though, I think some journalists have is that fans and readers don't know what they don't know. They don't know if the hard question was asked. So there are questions about this, but in the end, it does mean more content, more stories, more statistics, more blogs about sports.
But more of what? In the Costas interview with McGuire, he took some flack for not having pressed McGuire on his claim that even without the steroids, he would have broken the single-season baseball home run record. The larger question is, as we see more and more journalists going from newspapers to the direct employ of the very teams they cover, can we trust them to have an arm's-length relationship with the teams they're supposedly covering? And do you think the viewer will never figure out that something is amiss here?
I think it's too early to know what the full impact of this is going to be because we're so early in the trend. But I do think that readers are going to have to be discerning. And just as in politics, you read perhaps many different websites or different newspapers, different news outlets, you may need to do the same in sports and then do the compare and contrast. I think, though, that the league and conferences and teams do want credibility on their websites. And I think that does mean reporting some of the hard stories. Are they going to break a scandal on their site? I don't think we know the answer to that yet.
All right, Tim, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Former Baltimore Sun executive editor Tim Franklin is the director of the National Sports Journalism Center at Indiana University. For the lucky and talented few, there's being drafted by an NFL team. For everyone else, there's playing the ubiquitous virtual equivalent, the video game Madden NFL. For more than 20 years, Madden NFL has been as close as an armchair quarterback can get to the real thing. In this month's Wired, Chris Sullentrop observes that the video game has also had a huge impact on a generation of actual pro football players who have grown up playing hours and hours of Madden NFL. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You open with an anecdote about an early season game between the Denver Broncos and the Cincinnati Bengals this football season. 28 seconds left on the clock in a real football game. What happened?
Well, the Broncos are on the 13-yard line, their own 13-yard line. The quarterback drops back to pass. He heaves this somewhat desperation toss downfield. It gets deflected into the air, lands into the outstretched arms of a Broncos wide receiver, Brandon Stokley, who streaks toward the end zone for the winning touchdown. And that was an amazing play known as the Immaculate Deflection. But more remarkable than the funny bounce is that Stokley cuts right across the field horizontally and lets about 6 seconds drain off the clock before meandering into the end zone because no one was near him to tackle him. And at that moment, for a certain brand of football fan, the video game playing football fan, you were like, holy cow, did he just pull off a video game move? When I asked Stokley that question directly, he said, yeah, of course, that was a video game move.
Now, before we go into other examples of this kind of video game influence, let's just talk for a moment about Madden NFL. So ubiquitous and so good that it actually has the monopoly. The NFL granted it exclusivity to use its players and logos and so forth. The point being that everyone who is currently in the NFL who played video games as a kid, and that's probably close to everybody, played their football video game on Madden NFL.
That's right. I mean, if you think about it, an NFL rookie is 22 or 23 years old. They're pretty much the same age as Madden. They've been playing an extremely sophisticated football simulation their whole lives. And football is not like basketball or baseball where you play hundreds and hundreds of games a year or even scores of games a year. You play a handful, even in high school, college, and the pros. Pros, you play a few handfuls, right? 16 games. But playing Madden, you can play hundreds, thousands of simulated games, reading defenses, seeing routes, and like Stokley did, putting you in certain unusual situations that coaches aren't going to teach you. No coach taught Brandon Stokley not to walk into the end zone if you happen to be in the situation where you're running toward the end zone near the end of the game and maybe you could drain some clock so you should run around on the field for a while. That's just something you learn from playing video game football.
Now, presumably, this would most benefit receivers and especially quarterbacks who, in real game situations, have to make their reads based on the defense that they see arrayed before them and then to let the play develop accordingly. And therefore, you would think that quarterbacks, having the benefit of all of this simulation over the years, are better at their jobs than they were, say, 25 years ago. Has efficiency of quarterbacks and receivers gone up?
Anecdotally, it sure seems like it. I mean, you do play basically as the quarterback in these games, and it sure seems like a lot more rookie quarterbacks are succeeding at early years in the NFL, guys like Mark Sanchez of the Jets, Ben Roethlisberger of the Steelers, Matt Ryan of the Atlanta Falcons, Joe Flacco of the Baltimore Ravens. And in college, you have a 19-year-old rookie starting for the University of Southern California Trojans. These are things that were totally unheard of, I think, even 10 years ago. When Peyton Manning came into the league, he was the only rookie who started for his team at quarterback. And most quarterbacks had to go through a sort of tutelage on the bench to learn how to read NFL defenses. Nowadays, college has more passing, high school has more passing, and I think, and a lot of players think, and even high school coaches think, it's because these kids come in familiar with offensive formations, defensive formations, play calls, terminology, jargon that 20 years ago kids just didn't know.
So pro football has some very flamboyant characters, some outsized egos. And, you know, I can't help but wonder if some of these players, knowing that their various moves and stylings on the field may end up being immortalized in Madden, whether they actually changed their play on the field for their digital legacies.
Professional athletes certainly complain to the Madden game developers all the time about their rankings and about how they're characterized in the games. Chad Ochocinco for the Cincinnati Bengals this year threatened to boycott the game because he thought it underrated his abilities. But whether Chad Ochocinco is performing particular moves in the hopes of being immortalized in Madden, I don't know that we've quite gotten there yet.
Is there any question in your mind but what we will get there?
I'm certain that there are young football players for whom video games, and in particular Madden, is the primary metaphor through which they understand the sport. Once upon a time, young football players, or just young fans, when you met an athlete, you would think, gosh, I saw him on TV. Nowadays, when Brett Favre arrived at Minnesota Vikings and at the Jets, players said things, you know, I used to play him in Madden. And it is an organizing metaphor for how fans and players alike understand the sport.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Chris Sullentrop's article, Game Changers, How Video Games Trained a Generation of Athletes, is in the February issue of Wired magazine. Last month, the Wall Street Journal did some investigative football game watching and came up with a shocking revelation. Having sat in front of four NFL football games with stopwatches in their hands and having broken down every second of the broadcasts to determine what viewers actually see during a three-hour-plus game, the journal concluded that after the cheerleader shots and the announcer in the booth shots and the crowd panning shots, viewers see a grand total of 11 minutes of football. 11 minutes. For fans, the study simply confirmed that TV football is much more than a recording of a game. Instead, the broadcast directors create an entire narrative around the mere football game, a story that they tell using interviews and narration and a vast variety of shots. Bob Fishman is a legendary game director for CBS Sports, and he says that the Wall Street Journal study kind of misses the point.
I would love it to be 11 minutes. I'd show up, have a cup of coffee, do 11 minutes, and go home and get paid for it. But it takes a tremendous amount of preparation, and then obviously during the telecast, what goes on in the TV truck is something that the viewers don't get to see, but that's a show in itself.
You are in a tractor trailer parked underneath or outside the stadium. There are, a lot of monitors arrayed in front of you. What are you doing during the course of a game?
My job, basically, is to decide what you, the viewers, see at home. And we have an array of cameras, we have an array of angles, and it's constant nonstop calling of shots and telling my camera crew what I want on every particular play.
So what would it sound like, just if we could isolate your voice from everything else that was going on in the truck, what would we hear coming out of your mouth during a part of a game where, you know, there's actual plays in progress?
Well, let's take the opening kickoff, for example. I might say something like, camera one, return man, standby camera two, camera three, give me the far side coach, camera six, I want you to give me the near side coach. Now the ball is kicked. Take two. Run back happens, and I might say three, close up, linebacker, take three. Four, give me a defensive coordinator, take four. Camera two, get back to so-and-so. And it's a constant flow of information that I'm giving to my camera crew.
I don't know how many cameras you have on various angles of the kickoff, but after the play is over, let's just say the return man took the ball 5 yards deep in the end zone, ignored his teammate who was trying to tell him to keep it in the end zone for the touchback, and ran out and got only to the 12. Are you telling any cameraman to make sure he follows the guy to the bench to see if the special teams coach chews him out?
Reactions is a big part of what we do, because as a director, and I'm only speaking for myself, I think the emotional part of the game is kind of interesting. You know, we have a thing in our business called, you know, goats and heroes. There's a guy who's doing well on a play, and there's always a guy who's screwing up on a play. And those reactions we weave in and out of a broadcast. So in the case of what you just proposed, a guy is supposed to kneel down his teammate, and you clearly see the teammate saying, stay there, and he runs out. I need a reaction of the coach, of the special teams coach, whatever, and the player going to the sideline.
In those briefings that coaches give network crews in the days before the game, they apparently sometimes say, we're going to run such and such a specific play to this receiver or this back because we have seen such and such a weakness in the films. I got to ask you if in, let's say, the Steelers-Ravens game, if the Saturday before the game, the Ravens ever try to, you know, take you out for drinks to find out what the Steelers told you in the pregame briefing.
Never happened. If we know a certain player is not going to play, he's listed as questionable, and we are told he's really like out of the game, and sometimes that we will be told that. Mm-hmm. We would never share that information with the other team. If they don't say it's off the record, it's on the record. But as far as giving team information and injury information, and we're going to run a flea flicker on the first play, that is absolutely never shared with anybody, and nobody's asking to go out and have drinks with us.
So the game's on CBS this Sunday, but you're not directing. When you sit and watch the game, are you going to be shouting at phantom cameras? Can you sit down and relax? How do you watch the game as a civilian?
You know, it's hard for a director not to be aware of something that makes no sense, a shot that wasn't there, a situation in a game that's crying out for a shot, a reaction shot of somebody who messed up or somebody who did well. So, yeah, I mean, I can't sit here and lie to you and say that that hasn't happened, and it's happened plenty. But generally, I can just sit there as a fan and enjoy it and, you know, hope it's a good game.
Bob, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. I enjoyed talking to you.
Bob Fishman is a game director for CBS Sports. Coming up, for journalists, post-traumatic stress is not limited to war zones. It can happen right at home. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. This week marks a solemn anniversary for the small town of Kirkwood, Missouri. 2 years ago this weekend, a town resident named Charles Cookie Thornton walked into a routine Kirkwood City Council meeting and shot and killed several people. In total, 7 people died from the injuries they sustained that night, including Thornton himself. It was pulp nonfiction of the sort that cable news can't get enough of.
He opened fire, killing 2 police officers, 2 city council members, and
once inside, witnesses say Thornton immediately kills a second officer, then the public works director.
Mayor Mike Swoboda is in critical condition.
But for local journalists, the tragedy wasn't just a big story. It was personal. One of the Webster Kirkwood Times' 4 reporters was in the council chamber when the shooting happened, seated behind one of the council members who was shot to death. Meanwhile, the other reporters worked tirelessly to cover the shootings that night. Now, looking back, Times editor and publisher Don Corrigan says the incident changed him and his reporters forever because the community was his own and the people killed were his friends, acquaintances, and neighbors.
When you know these people, you've gone to lunch with them, you've been on a walking trail with them, you've talked to them at social occasions. It's no longer a headline and word. It's people you knew.
In what ways did this change just the worldview of your reporters and editors? Has it altered, in general, everybody's approach to journalism?
There's not the same enthusiasm for the big story. We just recently had another workplace shooting here in St. Louis. 3 were killed, 5 were injured, and nobody wanted to really take on that assignment.
Killings have taken away your killer instinct.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting the night that it happened. When I got out there in front of City Hall, I was surprised to be met by my student journalists who were out there. They were so excited about this big story, and they were going to have this story to be a part of their portfolio. And for me, I wasn't a reporter anymore. These were people who I knew who died. And I was proud of my students that they were out there in the wee hours of the night and talking to people. But at the same time, I saw reporters from a different viewpoint than I'd seen before.
On the subject of looking at journalism from a brand new point of view, you and your staff discovered what it's like to be part of a story that the national press was interested in as well. You had some good experiences and a whole mess of bad ones. Give me the highlights and lowlights.
Probably the low point for me was a call about 1:32 in the morning after this had happened, and the CBS morning show wanted an interview with our reporter who witnessed this firsthand, and I said, I'll call her in the morning. She's in no state to talk with anybody at this point, but I'll let her decide whether she wants to talk to you. And I don't want to really get down on the network in this case because it may have just been an intern calling. But whoever it was just said, well, you have to understand that America wants to reach out to your reporter who went through this. I said, well, you're going to have to wait till the morning till I have a chance to talk to her and see if she wants to do this. And they said, well, you don't understand. We go on the air in about 3 hours. We have to start arranging this now. And I said, well, that's not my problem. And then it was sort of like they're upping the ante and saying, well, Katie Couric wants to reach out to your reporter. And I just said, look, I know you're trying to do your job. I've sort of been there myself. Finally, this comes out. If I don't get this interview, my boss is going to kill me. I thought to myself, well, if your boss kills you, the Webster Kirkwood Times will reach out to you. But I hung up the phone at that point. On the positive side, Chris Bury at ABC Nightline called me and wanted to do an interview. And I had a number of funerals to attend. And I just said, Chris, I just don't know that I can do this. And he said, you know what? Don't worry about it. It's more important to be human at this point. And that's something I'll carry with me.
The shootings were a tragedy for your newsroom and also for the community at large, which is to say your readers. And I wonder how your readers have reacted to you. Has the tone or substance of the mail that you get changed in the intervening 2 years?
Some readers said, this is a crazy man. This is an aberration. Do not draw this out. Do not keep writing about racism charges in the community or how this had socioeconomic overtones. And then there were others in the community who said, you have to keep writing about it. I mean, there was even questions about how do we cover Cookie Thornton's funeral, the shooter? Where do we place that in the midst of all these other funerals? Should it even be in the paper? People were insulted that we covered it. But you know what? Cookie Thornton's family and relatives were just as much victims as anybody else in this.
I'm curious with what you think to be the journalistic moral of this story. What do you know now, having experienced this at your paper, that you just didn't have a clue about before?
Well, I've never subscribed to the idea that any reporter can be totally objective. It's impossible to stay detached and objective and aloof from what happens to people in these situations. It's not the right way to report. I know people, reporters who have been involved in shooting incidents that have gotten involved in the Brady anti-gun organization. Does that mean you shouldn't report on it? Does that mean your editor pulls you off on it? You may learn and know a lot more about what happened and why it happened because you got involved. In that sense, it's sort of made me question some of the things that I was taught in journalism school about objectivity and detachment.
Well, Don, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob.
Don Corrigan is the editor and co-publisher of the Webster Kirkwood Times. He wrote about the shootings and about how journalists can cope with trauma for Harvard University's Nieman Foundation for Journalism. The death last week of famously reclusive author J.D. Salinger prompted remembrances and elegies from friends and critics in the literary world. That was last week. This week, critics have dried their eyes and are mostly occupied with a more prosaic question. Did Salinger, author of Catcher in the Rye and Franny and Zoe, write any more books? His last story was published nearly 50 years ago, but he claimed to have been writing up until his death. There's no way of telling yet if he did write more books or if we'll ever get to see them. But we thought we'd call Slate columnist Ron Rosenbaum to see what he thinks. We last spoke to Rosenbaum in the fall when the late Vladimir Nabokov's unfinished novel was published.
Rosenbaum had written about his own conflicted feelings about whether the novel, which the author had wanted destroyed, should be released. Ron, welcome back to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
At a minimum, Salinger was an eccentric man. Can you tell me some of the quirks that may have something to do with his absolute imposed exile from the literary world?
I would say that in some way there's been too much emphasis on him as a nutty, eccentric crank and not enough emphasis on the fact that his silence, his rejection of celebrity culture, of the whole media industrial publicity complex, was a kind of principled stand and deserves respect.
Media industrial industry complex, very good, General Eisenhower. But it wasn't just that he refused to participate in the celebrity culture. He also refused to participate in literature. That is to say, if he has been writing all along, he declined to send it to publishers, either magazine editors or book publishers.
Right.
Does anyone know why that is?
He has made a few statements on this to the effect that he doesn't care or enjoy the process of publishing and getting reviewed and all that sort of thing. And he's in a position where he can write for his own pleasure and presumably for posterity.
Well, as to whether he was writing for posterity, I guess we'll know once his literary executor, or just plain executor, reveals what has or has not been accumulated over these past five decades.
Right. But you never know with these things whether the estate will be contested, whether the children will have a say in it, whether he's given specific instructions about his manuscript. So, you know, we could begin to see things in 6 months, or for all we know, it could be tied up in litigation for 6 years.
And not for no reason. As we've seen in the Nabokov episode, the children can absolutely disregard the author's dying wishes. Now, we don't know what the will says to begin with, but do you have any reason to think that there is a controversy brewing?
Well, I wrote a Slate column about 6 months ago when Salinger was suing some guy who was writing a novel about Holden Caulfield in his 60s. Salinger was suing him because he owned Holden Caulfield, and my column was titled, "Let's Save the Salinger Archives," because who knows, he could make a Nabokov-like move and say, in his will, burn everything. It's not like we could have faith in the stability of his judgment at this point.
As you were in the case of the Nabokov manuscript, or partial manuscript, you seem ambivalent about Salinger. On one hand, you've written approvingly about his life decision to stay out of the glare of publicity. On the other hand, you wrote kind of approvingly of your pal and WNYC music host Jonathan Schwartz's plan to break into Salinger's house to steal the stuff so that he couldn't destroy it before he died. What's your feeling now that Salinger has in fact passed away?
I would say that I think Jonathan and I and a number of Salinger ophiles would often bat around the fantasy. I don't think we were about to commit the felony of breaking in and stealing his manuscripts. On the other hand, I found on Amazon some self-published book about a gang that breaks in and steals Salinger's manuscripts. So it's a common fantasy.
Ron, I'm sorry. I just have to say this. Having all of your teeth fall out, common nightmare. Giving a book report with nothing on but your T-shirt, common. Breaking into J.D. Salinger's home and stealing his life work, less common. I do not think two constitutes commonality, I'm just saying.
I think that I phrased it common fantasy among Salinger-ophiles.
Okay.
So.
So we've established that Salinger was publicity averse in the extreme. But it created this mystique about him that is, among other things, I'm sure helped the lasting interest in Catcher in the Rye and his short stories. I'm wondering why, apart from maybe Thomas Pynchon, other authors have not glommed on to the same gimmick to at least fake media aversion in order to actually cultivate it.
Well, it's a good suggestion, except that first you'd have to care enough about their work, and I think that's what Catcher in the Rye did, is make people care about him. You know, one of the most interesting things said about Salinger's hiddenness was by a sort of fellow reclusive novelist, Don DeLillo, who in his book Mao, too, has a Salinger character. And he says, we're fascinated with reclusive authors because in some way they replicate the fact that God has hidden his face from us, that someone who has the answers is not going to reveal them to us.
Well, nonetheless, just in case the New York Times is listening, you can call me all you want, but I'm not going to grant any interviews about my book. Just put it out of your mind.
Good strategy.
Ron, as always, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob. Enjoyed it.
Ron Rosenbaum is a columnist for Slate and author most recently of The Shakespeare Wars. While nobody knows what's in J.D. Salinger's safe, there is some unpublished Salinger material that's already found its way to the outside world. Princeton's Firestone Library has a trove of unpublished Salinger stories. You're not allowed to check them out or even to photocopy them, but one of our producers, PJ Vogt, is so obsessed with them that he spent the last 2 weekends driving the 2 hours to New Jersey just to sit in a room with them. He's obsessed with one story in particular titled The Ocean Full of Bowling Balls.
This one was the one that had made me go to Princeton to see it in the first place. It's this story that's kind of like mythical among Salinger obsessives. It's written about on the internet, and because you're not allowed to publish it, the only thing you can read online are these sort of synopsis of what happens in the story. I didn't read it first when I got there because I wanted to save it, and when I finally read it, I was just convinced it was the best story I'd ever read.
Wow. The best story you've ever read. And can you give me your synopsis?
So it's set in the Caulfield family, and it's about Holden's older brother, who most people think is a stand-in for J.D. Salinger, and his youngest brother, who in the book becomes his dead sister.
Allie,
yeah. In this, Allie is a boy named Kenneth. And like a lot of young Salinger characters, it's this sort of wise, like, sage character who is always fated to die. So this is the story of the last day in the life of Kenneth. And it starts really beautifully. It's about how he always had upturned shoes because he was always stopping to look at things that he found that were wonderful. He'd like stop suddenly and his shoes would turn up. And then it talks about this day that the two of them, Vincent, the Salinger guy, and Kenneth had at the beach. And on the way to the beach, Vincent tells Kenneth about this short story he wrote, which is really bad and cloying, where a bowling ball is like a big plot piece in it. Mm-hmm. And when they get to the beach, Kenneth, who has a weak heart, decides he's going to go swimming. And Vincent is looking at the ocean, and he's really worried because it looks like the ocean's full of bowling balls. Like it's just like this, the seas look bad. And so Kenneth comes out of the water, and there's this great passage of him like walking up onto the shore and stumbling. And Vincent goes and grabs him and like drives him back to the house, and he dies. There's a couple of points early on where Kenneth dispenses these like pearls of wisdom that seemed really great when I was reading it. And another thing that happens in it that I like is that they talk about Holden Caulfield as being this snot, which you always want J.D. Salinger to say so that you know that he's not secretly Holden Caulfield. Mm. But I could not tell you why I thought reading that it was the best story that I ever read.
You've seen this thing. You've had it in your hands. You didn't steal it, did you?
All right, well, the thing is...
Wow, I was looking for a straight no.
If you read about it online, they make this big hoopla about how tight the security is at the Princeton Library. So, you know, there's, like, multiple forms you have to sign, and there's special rooms, and there's a librarian that just watches you the whole time. And the first time I went, I found, like, it was a little bit exaggerated, but there really is a lot of security, and they really do watch you. The second time, there wasn't as much security. And I'm not saying that I did, but if one were so inclined, one could probably photograph every page of that story with
your telephone or something.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. If one were so inclined.
If one were so inclined.
I don't want to have too much information here, but after your second visit, did you still think this was the greatest story you had ever read?
No. I don't know if there's an aura around something that you can't possess, and if maybe if you were to possess it, that it loses something of the aura. But yeah, something was definitely diminished or lacking. It's the same story, but I didn't read it the same way.
Okay, PJ, thanks very much.
Thanks, Bob.
PJ Vogt is an assistant producer for On the Media. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and PJ Vogt, with more help from James Halver and Alex Goldman, and edited this week by our senior producer, Katya Rogers. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Dylan Keefe. John Keefe is our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.